go. Yeah.
Hey, hello, and welcome to Unbought and Unbossed, Canadian political news and views. This is show number 126. Today is June 17th, 2009. Unbought and Unbossed is an independent voice dedicated to presenting and discussing the political and social issues most relevant to Canadian citizens. This show contends that 9/11 is Canada's single most important issue, because the self-inflicted attacks of 9/11 are being used as the justification for the current overthrow of our democratic and sovereign nationhood, turning Canada into a corporate-driven plutocracy. The official story of the 9/11 terror attacks and the ensuing war of terror are deeply troubling and are at the forefront of this radio program. I strongly encourage listeners to question what you think you know about today's world events and to analyze the motives behind our traditional news sources. Each week, new segments of Unbought and Unbossed offer further evidence for these incredible claims, which are either omitted or distorted by the mainstream corporate media. Turn your televisions off. You are being lied to and conditioned to accept this madness as our inevitable future. We must work to return the future of the human race to its rightful owners. That's you. Our ignore it and maybe it will go away on its own mentality is killing us. It has to end now. It is high time to wake up and to educate, to learn, to work together, and to find the courage to act on our love for one another. Our every freedom is at stake in this battle for truth and accountability. The prize is nothing less than the health of our collective human soul. The revolution has begun. I suggest you find your role. Hey, welcome, friends. Bruce Coburn, as always, actions speak louder. Right now, we got DJ Shadow and Ashley McIsaac.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
So what do we have for you today? I have an interview, telephone interview, with Kevin Barrett. He's a, he's lots of things. He's an author, a former university lecturer, an internet radio show host, as well as the founding member of the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance, as well as he is a member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. He has a new book due out July 1st this year that puts 9/11 Truth at the end of the book, and that's part of the strategy for reaching an as yet unconverted audience. Psychologists will tell you that if you say several things in a row that the audience agrees with, then say something less obvious agreeable, for example, 9/11 Truth, you'll have a much better chance at getting a good response than if you lead with the thing they don't already agree with. There we are, Kevin Barrett. Let me see, his first book on 9/11 studies was Truth, Jihad... Where is it here? Oh, okay, it's called Truth, the Jihad, My Epic Struggle Against the 9/11 Big Lie. I've read from that in a past episode, and this will be the first time that Kevin Barrett will be a guest on the show. He's in Madison, Wisconsin, as far as I believe. We'll find out. So that'll take up perhaps the first hour. Something else that I have for you today. I have a new book, and I'm going to be reading from it. It is The Rough Guide to Conspiracy Theories. And I first purchased a rough guide of unexplained phenomena. And that was a fantastic read. It's just all these interesting little tidbits throughout history that we don't really understand. There's no explanation. Fascinating stuff. And anyways, this book here, Rough Guide to Conspiracy Theories, it is indeed a rough guide. I'm going to be looking at 9/11, of course. And these guys are not very honest. Big problem. It's full of distortions as well as outright lies about the truth community's research and evidence. The authors are James Mick Conakey, as well as Robin Dudge. So I'm going to take these guys to school and point out some of their obvious problems. It is distributed by Penguin Books. I believe this is the second edition, published 2008. I'm not feeling 100% tonight, and that's unfortunate. So I hope I stay with you guys for the full 2 hours. I have an audio piece that I'm going to play while I'm getting Kevin Barrett on the phone. And this is one of the classic pieces from the 9/11 truth movement. And what it is Kevin Barrett being interviewed on Fox TV on the Hannity and Combs show. This comes from 2006. This is, the full piece is maybe 5-6 minutes long. I've cut it down to about 3. And Sean Hannity and Kevin Barrett go at it. Oh, it is brilliant, brilliant audio piece, and well done, Kevin. So what we're going to do, I'm going to play that piece, and when we come back, we'll have Kevin Barrett on the phone. Okay, friends, be well, and back shortly.
So they presented in a fair and balanced manner.
Of course. In the classroom, I always present things in a fair and balanced manner. Outside the classroom, when I'm an activist or a satirist, I'll tell it like it is. Inside the classroom, I'll present all of the defensible interpretations and let the students use their own critical reasoning skills to come to their own conclusions.
All right, Mr. Barrett, Sean Hannity here. Do you really believe that 9/11 was an inside job, not just 9/11, but Madrid and Bali and the Zarqawi operation?
Well, you know, actually...
Hang on a second.
Do you believe personally...
that these are inside jobs, yes or no?
It's not quite that simple. I know that 9/11 was an inside job. Professor Stephen Jones has found residue of formate on the steel samples from the World Trade Center. We now know that it was taken down in a controlled demolition.
All right, so you believe that the buildings came down in a controlled demolition, right?
Well, I don't believe it. I've looked at the evidence, the evidence is overwhelming.
All right, the evidence is overwhelming to you because you're a conspiracy nut. But
no, actually, all of you, I ask your viewers to take a look at this evidence for themselves. They can go to st911.org. That's Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Take a look. Take a look at the demolitions.
I know you think
Morgan Reynolds,
the
former Bush administration official, says that the Bush administration blew the World Trade Center to kingdom come. That's a direct quote from a member of the Bush administration itself. They blew the World Trade Center to kingdom come.
The Jews were told to leave. Well, we've heard a lot of these sick, bizarre theories.
That's not the
same thing. I don't believe any of them, but you're allowed to believe what you want, but that's not what's at hand here. The issue is whether or not you, with your bizarre theories, are the best.
I think you have the bizarre theory. You think it was 19 guys with box cutters led by a guy on dialysis in a cave in Afghanistan? That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the craziest conspiracy theory of all of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wish I had the Twilight Zone music. Now, here's my next question. The issue is at hand here. You're entitled to have your opinion. I don't really care what you believe. But if we're talking about a captive group of students in a classroom, the question
we've
got to
ask... captive.
Hang on a second. Well, they're sitting in your classroom, and you have a position of authority. I'm wondering, the question is whether or not you're the most competent to teach them. And most people think you're a nut. Most people think
we just had a poll here in Madison, and we found that 90% of the respondents at Channel 3000 poll said that I should be allowed to teach. Only 10% said I shouldn't.
That's the question.
And 60%.
I don't think what your views are.
60% agreed with me about the questions I'm raising about 9/11. 60% of the respondents.
I think you're
in the minority.
Right to speak. I don't think this is the proper forum, though, for people that hold extremist views like yourself. Reasonable
you guys are extremists. Fox News is the biggest bunch of extremists on the planet.
So reasonable people see you as an extremist, and I don't think you're the most appropriate guy to teach that class.
I don't think you're the most appropriate guy to be on the airwaves spewing your venom throughout this country. I think you guys should be taken off the airwaves because you are the guys who are...
We don't want to silence anybody. You teach, we'll do Hannity and Combs. Thank you, Professor. Coming up, we'll have a...
Very nice. I told you guys would enjoy that. Well done. As promised, Kevin Barrett is on the phone. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Raymond. Good to be with you.
Yeah, yeah. First time on. Let me see. I introduced you as, well, a lot of things, as an author, a former, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on, a former university lecturer, as well as a internet radio show host. I believe you have two shows. Do you still have two going on right now?
Yes, I do.
Okay, very nice. We'll get into that in a minute. Let me see. Founding member of the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance, as well as a member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. That's quite a bit.
Yeah, that's true.
You've been a busy fellow.
Yeah, technically, I don't think I'm a member of Scholars right now.
Okay.
But I provisionally resigned pending seeing a scientific paper from Jim Fetzer supporting his views on no planes at the World Trade Center.
Okay,
I'm
right.
I'm still waiting for that paper.
Okay, interesting. Now, as you know, I started off with that fantastic piece of yourself on Fox's Hannity and Combs. Can you tell us a little about that? That's been one of my favorite for a couple of years. I still think, you know, I get a giggle and it's, you know, I'm like, yeah, Kevin, give it to him. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences on TV? You've been on quite a few different shows.
Yeah, that Fox show with Hannity was kind of beginner's luck. I hadn't done any TV before that, really, or at least no major stuff. And it was kind of a strange situation. They shipped me over to Milwaukee in a limousine, so I had an hour and a half ride in a limousine over to the Fox studio, and then I had to sit up on this throne. It was like I was like 4 feet higher than all of these people at their desks surrounding me, and I had to look at a screen, but then they didn't put Hannity and Combs on the screen, so I couldn't see them.
Oh,
I could only hear them through
okay.
the headphones.
Right.
And it was very strange. I don't know, but I wasn't sure it went that well. Like afterwards, I thought, oh boy, did I lose it and get too angry at these guys?
Yeah.
But then my phone started ringing and people started saying, hey, that was great.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. You were also on what's that other knucklehead? Bill O'Reilly. You were on his show.
Yeah. That other knucklehead is pretty much right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he actually went after me. He tried to get me on his show more than 10 times.
Really?
From July 2006 through December 2006. And then finally I told him I couldn't come on while I was still teaching because I didn't want to cause the chancellor to, you know, keel over of a heart attack or anything.
Right. Well, maybe we can get into that because, you know, your name became front page 9/11 Truth news. Concerning a class you were going to teach on Islam, religion and culture, and it was going to include, at least in a very small piece, the effect of the September 11 attacks and the war on terrorism on Islam. Can you tell us about that story? Because that certainly was big news for quite a while.
Yes. Well, you know, that story, Raymond, is a good example of how the bad guys actually control the mass media and frame the stories because, you know, not that I was reluctant to participate in this story, but it was actually pretty much all arranged, I think, by the Republican spin machine. At that time, summer of 2006, Scholars for 9/11 Truth had just started and immediately racked up about 100 professors who were all either saying it was an inside job or strongly questioning the official story of 9/11. So the spin machine got pretty afraid of, you know, they were afraid this was going to turn into a juggernaut, and they realized that after going several years without answering the critics of the official story, at this point they were going to have to fight back, and they were going to have to fight back in an ad hominem fashion because they have absolutely no arguments to support the official story other than attacking the messenger.
Yeah.
So to do that, I think they started Googling around, you know, looking at these professors to see which of them might be vulnerable to an ad hominem attack.
Okay.
And they picked me, I think, probably because, I was pretty outspoken in my 9/11 views,
mm-hmm.
and I've been living at, you know, half the poverty line trying to raise children, you know, all this time, and just finished my PhD in 2004, was it? 2004. So I was fresh out of grad school with my PhD, didn't have a secure job, zero financial resources, deeply in debt, living in half the poverty line, and very outspoken on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably figured, here's the guy to bash. He won't be able to hire a lawyer to fight back.
Okay.
And indeed, that's true. I haven't been able to hire a lawyer, and I kind of wish I could sometimes. So they nailed me, and you know, I got invited on a right wing talk radio show and was ambushed. And you know, the show went on at 9 p.m. It was over at 11 p.m. Jessica McBride, this Republican host who's married to a guy running for Wisconsin Attorney General, put you know this blog out at midnight about how evil I was and these terrible things I'd said on her show. And then Steve Nass, the resident University of Wisconsin basher in the state legislature,
right.
put out a press release at 9 the next morning going after me and saying I should be fired.
Right.
You know, he's not a quick thinker, so if, you know, he said he just happened to read Jessica's blog. He must have been up at midnight trolling the blogosphere.
Right.
Because the whole thing was orchestrated, obviously. But I think it backfired on them. They bashed us and bashed me for that summer. And then they, after that summer or that semester, they just gave up.
Okay. Now, what do you have your doctorate in?
It's in African languages and literature with Arabic as my so-called African language, or my main one. And I sort of have an Islamic studies focus and a folklore minor.
Okay. Very nice. I have a literature BA, so you've got two levels of letters above me, so well done.
Well, if you want to, you know, collect literature degrees for a living, which is not the best way to make a living, I guess.
No,
so I've got master's degrees in French literature and English literature and African literature along with that PhD. So
wow.
I collected the full set.
Okay, very nice. Now, not your first book, but your first 9/11 book, Truth to Jihad, My Epic Struggle Against the 9/11 Big Lie. I've read from that on this show in the past. It is also said to be one of the only, or certainly the first, humorous looks at 9/11, and it's also somewhat autobiographical as well. Can you? What I want to do is lead into the book that you have coming out in a few weeks. But can you tell us a little bit about your first book? And how is it that you've got quite a sense of humor, and you've really thrown in a whole lot of things? It was a fun read because it was unlike anything I had read of 9/11 literature prior to that.
Yeah, well, you know, I've studied literature for a long time, and I used to study the literature of the absurd. I really enjoyed existentialism and theater of the absurd and absurd humor and black humor. And so, you know, once I realized that the Bush administration people and their military and intelligence minions had blown up the World Trade Center and lied about it and kind of gotten away with it, and the extent of this lie was so over the top. And the situation that we were in was just so, ludicrous. It really did remind me of this dark humor that I'd been studying years ago in college.
Right.
So, I one of the things about gallows humor is that it can kind of create a catharsis. You know, if you're really just overwhelmed by the horror of what you're facing, sometimes being able to laugh about it can actually save you.
Okay. You started off with different quotes that you had made up, one by Osama bin Laden saying, it really was a fun read from start to finish. It was very serious in tone as well.
Well, the black humor people say that in the 20th century, and I guess this would go for the 21st as well, you can't really be serious without being funny, and you can't really be funny without being serious. You know, those two genres kind of merged together in the 20th century as history went way over the top.
Yeah. One of the things that I remember reading from there, and I took a look to see if I could find the quote today, and I couldn't, but it was something to the effect of that you don't want to live in a world where 9/11 truth, the big lie will continue, and that will be the dominant history. And I commend you for that, and you've certainly, walked your talk.
Yeah, it's really a pretty horrible thought, to think that if this big lie stands, what kind of future will my kids have?
Yeah.
What'll be the next big lie? If they can get away with this, then what won't they try to get away with?
Mm-hmm.
And, won't they succeed? It really reminds me of the ending of 1984, mm-hmm. Orwell's great dystopian novel, where the last line is, the future is a boot stomping on a human face for all eternity. And that's the future we have in a non-9/11 truth world.
Yeah, that's right. I can't remember who said it not too long ago. They were suggesting that what if a similar truth movement arose, well, I suppose it did, but what if it insisted that the Kennedy assassination
that the truth was told there. You know, maybe we could have changed things right then and there, and, you know, the subsequent wars, and, of course, 9/11 wouldn't have happened, you know.
Well, that's a good point. The Kennedy assassination was a pivotal moment in the history of the dominant empire, you know, the last 100 years. And, indeed, if it had been exposed in a timely fashion, I think we would be in a much, much better world right now.
So what I would like to do is ask you about your new book. Can you give us a brief synopsis of this book you have coming out, I guess, July 1st, I believe?
Yes, it should be in print even a little before that. Okay. It's called Questioning the War on Terror,
okay.
A Primer for Obama Voters.
Mm.
And the idea was inspired by, well, various things, but there were, you know, a couple of friends of mine were saying that, you know, why can't we just, you know, ask questions? Why is it that these liberals and, you know, Chomskyite leftists and these people who, you know, corporate-funded or rather foundation-funded leftists who dominate the so-called opposition discourse in the U.S. Won't consider these very, very good questions about 9/11, even, you know, even if they aren't quite ready to accept the obvious answer. Why in the world aren't they raising hell over the questions? So
yeah.
let's frame a 9/11 truth book in the form of questions.
Yeah.
You know, I decided to sort of do it backwards from the way David Ray Griffin had done it in the New Pearl Harbor, where he put the, you know, the big smoking gun inside job issues right up front.
Right, right.
Demolition of the WTC, the, you know, Pentagon attack not being Flight 77, and so on. So I turned it around and started by just, you know, showing, you know, asking questions that caused the whole, you know, notion of the war on terror to fall apart before you even get to 9/11, like pointing out that, you know, your chances of, you know, dying from lightning strikes are 10 times your chances of dying in a terrorist attack.
Right, right.
You know, you're twice as likely to drown in your bathtub as to die from a terrorist attack. So this whole scare about terrorism that we've been living with now for almost a decade is complete and utter ludicrous nonsense, whether or not 9/11 was an inside job. So therefore, given that we've been living with this insane propaganda that can be demonstrably shown to be complete nonsense,
right,
you know, that should start people really asking questions about, well, what's really going on here with this so-called war on terror?
Yeah, yeah, good point. On one of Amy Goodman, who is someone that you've had some pretty stern things to say about her. Again, the way you led in your book talking about the foundation-funded progressive media, and that is probably the key point, foundation-funded. So thank you. Oh, shit, where was I going?
I can pick up from there because, you know,
okay, please,
what
do.
Got me into this, more, you know, got me into it in a really big way was in the fall, or, when was this? This was actually, I guess, spring of 2004. David Ray Griffin was scheduled to go on Democracy Now! Along with Ellen Mariani, who was suing Bush for doing 9/11.
Okay.
Would have been a great show. At the last minute, Amy Goodman canceled Ellen Mariani and brought on this professional debunker, Chip Burley, a man who lives on $500,000 a year from the Ford Foundation, which also happens to be a major funder of Democracy Now!, and which gave Amy Goodman more than $100,000 right after 9/11 to, quote-unquote, report on the aftermath of 9/11.
Mm.
And, of course, what that really was to not report on the truth about 9/11.
Yeah, yeah.
So when that happened, and, you know, Amy Goodman with all of her Ford Foundation CIA money and Chip Burley with his $500,000 a year from the CIA-linked Ford Foundation, when those two got together and then ambushed David Ray Griffin in a really deceptive way, that just pissed me off. And I said, the hell with it. I'm not going to keep going with this university career. You know, at that time, I was about to go take a really great postdoc at the University of California that was funded by the Ford Foundation. I said, the hell with it. And from then on, I've been pretty much, you know, full-time working for 9/11 Truth and getting into worse and worse financial shape.
Right, yeah. So shortly, you hosted David Ray Griffin, a lecture at the University of Wisconsin. And now, was that kind of your first 9/11 stage presence?
Stage presence, sort of. I had done teach-ins on the University of Wisconsin campus quite a bit before that.
Okay, all right.
Throughout 2004, I was doing those teach-ins. And on September 11, 2004, I did a 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. marathon teach-in in the heart of the University of Wisconsin campus.
Huh.
So then it was spring 2005 when we got David to come to Madison.
Okay.
And that turned out really well.
Yeah, it sure did.
Because C-SPAN decided to cover it, and that led everybody else to cover it, too.
Yeah. Yeah. How is it that C-SPAN showed up there?
Well, everybody thinks I'm some kind of public relations genius to have gotten them to show up, but actually they called me, and they had to work to find me because my kids answered the phone the first time they called, and they left the answering machine greeting. That's right. It was this bizarre answering machine greeting like, welcome to outer space or something like that.
Huh.
So C-SPAN gave up for a day, and then I managed to call back when I was there, and I was just there to answer the call the second time they called. That's all I did to get C-SPAN to come.
Yeah. Okay, so is there, in your new book, Questioning the War on Terror, I'm not exactly sure when you completed writing it, are you talking about the Obama presidency at all, or how does that play in?
Well, you know, I'm an admirer of Webster Tarpley's work, and he's really going after Obama, maybe a little more even than Obama deserves. Webster's very, very harsh on him. But
he's written two books on him already.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he does. And they're great books. Everybody needs to read those books. But, you know, I tried those books out on my Obama voting friends and relatives, and the result was not very encouraging. They got about a paragraph into it and then threw it down in disgust because these people all have an emotional identification with Obama.
Yeah.
They're all happy that we got rid of Bush and Cheney, the evil psychopaths, and they just don't want to hear this. So I'm sort of trying to, you know, approach this from a different angle, which is to, gradually help these people look at the concept of the war on terror with a sort of a spin that says, look, you know, maybe Obama actually would be happy if we all rose up and demanded a true investigation of, you know, torture, which would lead to the fact that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was tortured into a false confession for 9/11,
right.
Tortured into approving a pre-approved script that had probably been written before 9/11 by Philip Zelikow, who later was put in charge of the investigation. You know, if this thing breaks wide open, it will be great for the Democrats in 2010 because, you know, the ruling party always wins. I mean, they always lose the midterm elections, often catastrophically. And when the economy is as bad as it is now, the Democrats better get ready to get completely clobbered in the next election unless they expose the worst crimes of the Bush-Cheney presidency.
Right.
And so I'm trying to, you know, ease the Obama voters into seeing that they need to rise up and push the Democrats into opening this can of worms.
Okay. Can you paraphrase what Tarpley has to say about Obama for our listeners that haven't read his books yet?
Sure. Tarpley says Obama is a complete fraud. He's controlled by the CIA, by Zbigniew Brzezinski, the New World Order crowd, the bankers who are trying to conquer the world, and that, you know, he was groomed for this by Brzezinski when Brzezinski was a professor of Russian studies at New York University when Obama was there, and Obama actually got his degree in poli-sci, apparently, with Brzezinski in the department. The circumstantial evidence that Obama was selected and groomed by Brzezinski and his trilateral commission, you know, CIA big banker enablers, is pretty strong. And so Obama was basically picked as a future leader in the same way that the Trilateral Commission selected Jimmy Carter and a couple of other Southern governors to be a future president back in the early 1970s.
Yeah, yeah.
So Obama's a fraud. He's not just some guy who just happened to, you know, get elected. He's a guy who was selected by the secret government at least a couple of decades ago. And he's pushing through the secret government's agenda.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there is such a thing as politics, you know, they're playing politics, and the secret government is not monolithic, and it's not in complete control.
Right.
So there's no reason why we couldn't push Obama and the Democrats into, you know, playing hardball and at least destroying the Republicans with the crimes of the Bush administration, such as 9/11. Of course, maybe some of the Democrats would get hammered there, too, some of the secret government people who are too powerful to go down would get hammered there, too. So things would have to get pretty extreme, I think,
right,
for the stuff to be brought out. But there's a chance.
Yeah, I don't recall who I read this from, but this author was suggesting that there's an ebb and flow in the power structure of these elite secret societies. You know, you've mentioned a couple of the big American ones. And at times, they're, you know, their control is a little bit more peaceful, and at other times, they're going to do a 9/11 and, you know, an extended war on terror.
Indeed. And I think there are genuine differences of opinion among people who are highly placed in these power structures. One example is the Council on Foreign Relations, which people are always citing as kind of a prototypical elite group. There are people of very different opinions on it. You know, there are neoconservatives of hardcore Straussian stripe, which means basically Nazis. Mm-hmm. And then there are also people like Richard Falk. He's, I believe, still a member of CFR. Richard Falk, he was on my radio show recently. He wrote the introduction to David Ray Griffin's seminal 9/11 truth book, The New Pearl Harbor.
That's right.
And you know, Richard Falk is a really great guy.
I believe he's also calling for a something in the UN, is he not, with 9/11? Did you cover that on his recent interview?
Well, yeah, that was actually when he came on my show. He said that we needed to investigate the neocons for 9/11. And then a few days later, the New York Post, I think it was the Post, had a front page headline, UN official calls for investigation of neocons for 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
So that whole scandal came out of Richard's appearance on my show, and I think he took a little bit of flack for it, but he hung in there, and he still got his job with the UN. He's still calling for human rights for the Palestinians and war crimes trials for the Israelis. So he's a wonderful guy. Just because he's on the CFR doesn't mean that he's a bad person.
Yeah. Another person I could is Bill Moyers.
Bill Moyers, yeah. You know, I wish Bill Moyers would take 9/11 and pick it up and run with it, but I heard rumors back in 2006 that pro 9/11 truth guy. Well, there was Ed Asner, apparently, was one of them. And I think there were another. There was another guy or two who were at a party with Moyers and brought it up. And Moyers went into a real fit of ranting about stupid conspiracy theorists.
Huh. Okay.
So
okay.
He was not hip to it in 2006. Maybe right. He's waking up now. I don't know.
Because he's done a lot of work over many years. You know, exposing the corruption of the American federal government and its power system.
He has, although, whether he's gone the crucial step, I don't know. You know, he used to work for President Johnson, who, climbed to power over the bloody corpse of John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
And he never really fully faced that. And, he looked at the secret government around Iran-Contra a little bit, but I don't think he's really, gone all the way in recognizing just how corrupt things have gotten.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, very nice. Okay. There was one other point I wanted to make about Obama. From what I understand, this comes from Tarpley, that who was it? Rockefeller, a foundation of his, gave Obama his first job after his schooling.
Well, that's right. And indeed, that job looks like it was sort of CIA related. It was kind of a light intelligence job.
Okay.
I forget exactly what it involved, but it was some sort of collecting intelligence from abroad and writing it up.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, I certainly wish you success with that, and I'm looking forward to purchasing your book, and I recommend listeners to do the same.
Well, they don't. A lot of your listeners, Raymond, probably know a lot of the information, perhaps most of the information in my book.
Okay.
But I think they'll find it a good read and a good compendium of key information that blows up the whole notion of the war on terror. But most importantly, they should get this book to give to their Obama voting friends who haven't figured these things out. And it's published by a nonprofit which is offering for $50, maybe a little more in Canada because of the shipping, you can get 10 copies, for only $5 a piece.
Oh, no kidding.
Giveaway, yeah.
Ah, okay, because I've got some progressive peaceniks in my community that won't touch me or 9/11, and it's pretty damn frustrating, going up against these guys. And, actually, I'll give them more credit than that. They do know that 9/11, that there's tons of problems in the story, but it doesn't, they won't cross that threshold. I don't know if it's for fear of what, being labeled a loony by, the loonies on TV, I guess.
Well, I think my book is a good one for people like that, because it, questioning the war on terror. Well, who's against questioning the war on terror? I mean, it's a good gateway drug to help people like, your friends actually, go ahead and look at these issues. And, it could be shipped to their door in a plain brown wrapper right. If they need that.
Okay, very nice. Is there anything else, or can we move on to some new ideas?
New ideas are always welcome.
Okay, nice. You ran for Congress in Wisconsin State in 2008. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yes, it was rewarding in many ways, frustrating in other ways, but it's not that hard to run for Congress.
Okay, now were you an independent? Or
I was running as a libertarian.
Okay.
I'm the world's only libertarian who favors single-payer health care.
Hmm.
Along the Canadian model.
Okay.
So I was running as kind of a left libertarian. I think that the problem with the Libertarian Party is that, the advantage is they're based on freedom, which is under attack everywhere. So everybody should be racing to become a libertarian. But the problem is they're completely wedded to this really kind of hard, you know, Ayn Rand kind of Friedman Chicago School, you know, Republican style of economics.
Okay.
And although I'm all in favor of, you know, keeping the economy largely free market, especially at the lower levels, I think that the general run of the libertarians is just too close to the Republicans for my taste. In some ways, they're actually more radical than the Republicans on economic issues. So I'm kind of a populist on the economic issues. So I thought I would try to, you know, balance the libertarians out a little better. And I don't know. I won the primary 60-40, so I guess there are some voters out there who agree with me.
Okay. Okay. Now, but, was 9/11 a major issue for you? Was that something you were pushing?
Oh, sure. Okay. Of course. You know, that's what I'm known for. So every time I was mentioned in the media, it was, you know, Kevin Barrett, the 9/11 conspiracy monger, and things like that.
Right.
And occasionally, you know, they mentioned me fairly, perhaps, you know, one out of every four or five mentions.
Okay.
But I got a lot of media in Wisconsin. I was on Wisconsin Public Radio three times, I think, three or four times during the campaign, and was able to have a debate with the incumbent, Ron Kind, who's one of the worst of the, you know, sleazy Democrats who takes lots of special interest money and just keeps rubber stamping all of the bad stuff.
Yeah.
The wars and the attacks on civil liberties and so on. So I got in a debate with him. He said he would debate me early on, and then he didn't. And finally, at the end of the campaign, he debated me and the Republican. And I think it was a great event. You know, it can be found on the Internet, I think, by way of RadioDuJour.com.
Very nice. I didn't know that that was online. I haven't seen that one yet.
Yeah, it's I think one of the, you know, it was the highlight of the campaign for me was finally getting a chance to stand up and, you know, tell the truth in Ron Kind's face.
Yeah. And how did he respond? Was he on his game that day, or did you trip him up?
Well, unfortunately, it wasn't a back and forth thing. It was a, you know, the Republican stands up and speaks for 5 minutes. Democrat speaks for 5 minutes, and then that crazy libertarian speaks for 5 minutes.
Right.
But I think he looked kind of shamefaced. You know, I think that what I was saying actually did make him feel a little bit ashamed of himself.
Okay, very nice. Yeah, that idea of capitalism, I don't have so much a problem with capitalism, provided that it's about what they say it is on TV, but in reality it's about monopoly, that, you know, the complete opposite. So if you agree with that, then I'm with you on it.
I agree completely, absolutely. Right now my campaign website is down, but if you're able to go to it, it should be back up soon. You go to my issues page, you'll see that I was calling for busting up the big monopolies. If you want to have a free market with real competition, you need to have a number of smaller players. And, you know, right now we've just got cartels and monopolies everywhere. We need to, you know, bring back the antitrust wing of the Justice Department and bust up these big corporations, and especially the big media outfits. They should be smashed into thousands of pieces and scattered to the wind, as Kennedy said about the CIA before he was assassinated.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. We have a guest in common coming up. Excuse me. Jonathan Kay of the National Post. Now, the National Post is owned by Can West, which is one of the 10 Canadian corporations involved in the Security and Prosperity Partnership as well. Can West owns a huge chunk of Canadian media, and pretty much all of it in Western Canada. So Jonathan Kay, I think he's going to be on your show, the next week or two?
He's coming on Tuesday. People can find out about that by going to my website, which is truthjihad.com.
Okay.
And then just click on the radio schedule, and you'll see he's on Tuesday at noon Eastern time.
Okay, so that's Truth Jihad, J-I-H-A-D.
That's right.
Okay, very nice. Do you know about this fellow? It sounds as if he's going to be writing a book on 9/11. He's not saying too much about what it's going to be about, whether it's going to be a hit piece or, you know, he's just going to be looking at us peculiar fellows that, you know, are very passionate about something that's, you know, all wrong. You know, do you know anything about it? How did you get him? I mean, you're in the States.
Well, I actually follow what happens in Canada. To me, Canada is actually a couple of notches above the U.S. in its level of discourse in certain areas. And one of them is there are really more professors, especially, you know, proportion to population, who are telling the truth about things like 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
You have Tony Hall up there and Chasadovsky, you have a whole long list of these professors
and
global research. You know, so I do pay attention to Canada. I think it's an important place.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan Kay has been, you know, stepping into to write this book about 9/11 truth and stirring it up a little bit with some pro-truth people. So I think that's really an interesting situation. I like to have people on the radio I don't agree with, at least occasionally. I like to bring on somebody who can hold up the other end of a debate, and I'm interested in his project. I'm curious about how did he come up with this idea, especially, you know, assuming he's an intelligent person, which I suspect he must be, how could he pursue this project for an extended period without realizing that the truthers are right?
Exactly.
And then what does he do?
It doesn't take too long to find out there are holes, and if you look a little longer, you're going to find that the holes are more numerous and larger. So that's just the way it is. And, you know, if you disagree, that's interesting. You say that you like to have from time to time people that you disagree with. I can't get anyone to come on my show to discuss 9/11 from, you know, for them supporting the official side.
Well, I have that problem too, Raymond. And, you know, I've been looking for an honest defender of the official story for years, like Diogenes with the lamp running around the whole world looking for an honest man. And guess what? They don't exist.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just me. Back in 2006, when I was in the media spotlight, the History Club at the University of Wisconsin-Madison tried to find somebody to defend the official story in a debate with me and Jim Fetzer, and they couldn't find anybody. They canvassed the poli-sci department, the history department, on and on and on. Not one professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is willing to publicly defend the official story of 9/11. Same thing happened in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with the University of Michigan. Thousands of DVDs and invitations were delivered to professors there, and the only response they got was from two different engineering professors, both of whom said, well, of course you guys are right. It's an obvious controlled demolition, but if we see that in public, we will lose our funding and get in trouble, so we can't.
Yeah, right.
It's a bizarre situation. There's apparently no free speech around this issue.
Yeah.
You know, we've won the debate by default, but the media won't even, you know, look at this, even though it's the most important issue of the century.
Yeah, I agree. That's how I start off my show, that, you know, Canada's being sucked into. Well, I'm not saying it started at 9/11. It's much older than that. But, you know, we're certainly losing our democratic and our sovereignty, you know, and being swallowed into this North American Union due to the fear propagated because of 9/11.
And I think that the lack of honest opposition, you know, the lack of anybody who's willing to defend the official version in public, is part of the plan in a certain sense, because I see this as a neoconservative project above all. The neoconservatives are the cult followers of Leo Strauss, who was the number one student of the top Nazi professor, Carl Schmitt.
Right.
And Strauss wants to undo the Enlightenment. He thinks that reason is far too powerful a tool to be left in the hands of ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
So the way society should be run is that a very tiny group of strong, wealthy, powerful people should be taught how to use their reason, and those people rule the rest through big lies, and that everybody will be happier if the masses are ruled by big lies. In order to get back to this pre-Enlightenment situation where you have, you know, reason as a very, very scarce commodity in the hands of the ruling elite and everybody else living by irrational myths, I think that they wanted to stage an event that could not be subjected to the scrutiny of reason without completely undermining all legitimacy of the society and its government. So they did this. They, you know, blew up the World Trade Center in plain sight and you know, carried out this completely obvious, in-your-face false flag attack that if one speaks the truth about it, one destroys the legitimacy of the system that we all live in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, most people cannot speak the truth about it. And so reason cannot be exercised about the most important historical issue, and that's driving reason underground and replacing it with a system of irrational mythology. And you know, if this continues, we are going to be in that Orwellian, you know, future where the irrational mythology becomes totalitarian and absolute, and there'll be no hope of ever getting back to a genuinely democratic system where the majority of people have enough training in the use of reason and critique to be participate in governing themselves.
Well, after that, do we not graduate to a Orwellian, or, I'm sorry, a Huxley reality, you know, if this is a science-based new world order, you know, it seems, you know, this extreme fascism to... You know, what's next? If, you know, population control is, I mean, it's certainly a huge problem, and I don't think anyone should say, yeah, we need more people. I see that going from 1984 to a Brave New World is what I see, you know, long term.
Well, that's very possible. A lot of these technologies in Brave New World are definitely there. But at the same time, there's, you know, there's a real, you know, ugliness and big lie quality, you know, torture, you know, this 1984 is a more in-your-face, unpleasant world than Brave New World. And it seems like, you know, we have aspects of that really, you know, strong in-your-face unpleasantness and the big lie. Huxley also, you know, besides Brave New World, wrote a wonderful utopian novel called Island.
That's
right,
yeah. I don't
know if you've read that.
I have, yes.
Yeah, and I think he was onto something with this idea that, you know, the drift of history with the population level that we've got, the kind of technology that we have, is it works against the forces that could be used to create a much happier life for people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think his notion of what it would take to create a happier life for people in a happier society, most of it is pretty right on. That is the spiritual training in things like meditation,
mm-hmm.
And other forms of non-rational skills and, you know, cognition and imagination that he really was overly cerebral and overly trained in kind of rational academic scholastic style.
Well, his whole family for many generations were, you know, leaders in English thought.
Indeed, and of course, as he was too. But then he saw that having an educational system that pumps up your left hemisphere of your brain on steroids and completely neglects the right hemisphere and holistic thought and, you know, and meditation, control of your brain waves, control of your sense, your ability to use your senses, all of that, I think, was really insightful. And if we ever have a real educational reform that enables us to produce happier people, I think Huxley will perhaps be one of the inspirations for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope so. If I recall, it's been quite a few years since I've read it. This utopian community did indeed live on a small island where the rest of the planet was kind of in its modern state of not doing so well.
Well, that's right. And the rest of the world was quickly encroaching on that small island in the form of breaking in there and, you know, staging a coup d'etat to steal the oil resources. It's kind of ahead of its time there.
Hmm. Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, I also think that Islam has quite a few answers to our contemporary dilemmas.
Okay.
And of course, I'm biased. I'm a Muslim. But, you know, I think a religion that tells you that there can be no lending of interest and that has a tradition of no corporations, only individual responsibility, because the individual stands before God. There's no church, no bureaucracy between the individual and God, no intercessor figure. It's just you and God. I think these ideas have very good social consequences mm-hmm. as well as spiritual consequences.
Yeah, I have to say I agree with everything you just listed. So very nice. Let me see. I have a couple more things that I'm aware of you taking place in, and one I didn't get a follow-up. My buddy Wayne Pronte of Fraser Valley, formerly of Vancouver, 9/11 Truth, wanted me to ask a question about your trip to Morocco to look for the so-called 9/11 terrorists that, well, they were alive. And so can you fill us in on that? Did that happen? And what did you find?
Okay, well, the backstory there is that many of these alleged 19 hijackers turned up alive and were credibly reported alive in mainstream sources after 9/11. And one of them was a guy named Waleed Ashari. And he, according to the BBC, walked into the U.S. Embassy in Rabat, Morocco, shortly after 9/11, and said that the picture in the newspapers was him. The biography was his. He had indeed trained at the flight school in the U.S. that the biography said he had, but that he had had nothing to do with 9/11, and here he was.
Right. Okay.
So the BBC reported that, and then that story, which you would think would have, you know, really blown up, and you know, every newspaper person in the world would be on top of this guy saying, wow, what an experience being mistaken for the worst criminal of all of history. You know, what was it like? How did, you know, da 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 da. None of that happened. This guy just dropped off the face of the earth.
Okay.
And it's still very confusing trying to figure out, you know, just what was going on here. But it appears that he is from a well-placed Saudi Arabian family. He's probably one of these Saudi CIA snitches, or, you know, CIA people. Perhaps he was on loan from Saudi intelligence to U.S. intelligence to be set up as a 9/11 patsy. Maybe the Saudis didn't know that's what was going on. I don't know. But anyway, he comes from a well-connected family in Saudi Arabia, probably had intelligence connections, and presumably was either repatriated to Saudi Arabia, where he's not talking to anybody, or perhaps he was killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it sounds as if you did not physically make the trip to search him out, or?
Well, yeah. What I did was, you know, I wanted to call attention to the fact that all of these alleged hijackers turned up alive after 9/11. So to do that, I sort of played on my, you know, reputation in the mainstream media as this, you know, this kind of, you know, this crazy entertaining professor, and I, you know, went out and said I actually got licensed as a bounty hunter and said I was going to bring him back dead or alive. I don't know how you escaped that that suicide plane, Waleed, but that was the last miraculous escape you'll ever make.
No.
I'm going to bring you back in handcuffs. and the media actually kind of liked it, and so I got a lot of mainstream media coverage out of that, which did alert people to the fact that all these hijackers were, you know, been reported alive. I went over there, and I talked to the people at the embassy, and they'd all been rotated, so nobody who'd been there then was still there, so they knew nothing.
Okay.
Talked to the airlines, and the only, you know, the good thing information I got from them was I talked to a pretty high up guy at the Saudi airline, and he more or less confirmed by not denying that Waleed Ashari had actually been connected with the Saudi airline, not Royal Air Maroc, which was what the BBC had reported. And he also said, you know, we just don't want to get involved in this. I don't want trouble, you know. And he let on that he knew a lot more than he could say.
But it sounds like he's confirming the story, though.
No, he didn't out and out confirm anything.
Okay.
But except for more or less confirming that Waleed Ashari was connected to the Saudi airline, not Royal Air Maroc.
And
I did talk to Moroccan journalists who had also discovered shortly after the story ran that Royal Air Maroc was denying any kind of knowledge of this guy.
Okay. Shall we move on?
Sure.
You are the founding member of the Muslim-Jewish-Christian Alliance. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Is that still going on?
Sure. The rest of the title is Alliance for 9/11 Truth.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
We're not
that.
Trying to unite all the religions in one super religion. that can wait. That's probably even more quixotic than uniting them for 9/11 Truth.
Well, thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah. And the purpose of that group was that, you know, I thought that it's just horrible that the way that 9/11 was designed to create a 100-year war between Judaism and Christianity on one hand and Islam on the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really a replacement for the Cold War enemy, the communists. It's one thing to scapegoat and demonize with a certain philosophy like communism or certain nationalities like the Russians or whatever, but demonizing a religion is quite another thing. Religious warfare can bring up all sorts of powerful emotions, and it's really an ugly thing. So I was thinking that we need to bring these great Abrahamic faiths together to talk about the facts and meaning of 9/11, and specifically to look at the evidence that what happened wasn't what we were told. And, you know, my thought would be that if the religious, you know, Jews and Christians can have, you know, the guts to look at this reality and then sort of apologize to Muslims for framing Muslims for this horrible crime, this could lead to a real improvement in relations between people of these three religions.
Okay.
And it's, you know, I don't know if we've quite succeeded yet in awakening the majority of Jews and Christians to the need to do this, but at least, you know, we've made a few steps forward, and the organization continues now in the able hands of Lou Stoltzenberg, who's a Madison, I think she's a Methodist, who's been running it now for a couple of years.
Okay, okay.
And she's a little more low-key than me and, you know, less controversial, and I think she's, you know, she's a good person.
Sure, nice. Now, I'm going to guess that this alliance you put together nailed you the editor job of, the title of the collection is skipping me. Can you tell me the title you edited?
Sure, yeah. That was called 9/11 and American Empire, Volume 2. Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out.
Thank you very much.
Volume 1 was called Intellectuals Speak Out in the subtitle.
Yes.
And it was a bunch of professors. We had probably about 60-70% professors too, but we were, you know, they were all writing as members of one of the Abrahamic faith communities.
Okay. Okay. That's one of the truth books I have not read yet. I look forward to it one of these days. There's an awful lot out there, and well, you know how it is.
Indeed, indeed. Well, I think it's an underrated one. Many people who have read it, including people who, you know, read it late, long after it came out, have approached me saying, "Wow, this is really, you know, some amazing stuff in this book."
Okay, so that might make a good Christmas present for our religious friends.
It certainly could, and especially with all of these accusations of anti-Semitism that get tossed around. You know, this Holocaust Museum shooting is probably, you know, getting blamed on truthers is probably just, you know, stoking those fires. I think it's really great to open up a book like this and find, you know, find six important Jewish thinkers contributing to this 9/11 truth volume, with Rabbi Michael Lerner saying, you know, we need to start planning the post 9/11 truth world now so we can, you know, make really serious structural improvements in the world's distribution of resources. And so, you know, he's almost taking for granted that 9/11 truth, you know, could win, and then what?
Okay.
And so liberal Jewish people really should take a look at what Rabbi Lerner has to say in this essay. It's quite extraordinary.
Very nice. Well, I hope that's what happens. Moving on, I'm at 9 o'clock here on the West Coast. Are you at 11 right now?
I sure am.
Okay, so it's getting on in time. So I'd like to wrap this up fairly quickly. The final comment that I have is that you've been a host of, at least two radio shows that I know of. So I'm interested in that. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit of background to how you became a radio host.
Well, you know, actually, Raymond, I've been a host of five radio shows now.
Okay.
And I'm doing two at this point. And that all started back during that fall semester of 2006 when I was teaching the Islam class. Towards the end of that semester, I got contacted by RBN and GCN, which I guess are the two leading so-called Patriot radio networks. At that, you know, Alex Jones is with GCN. He might have been with RBN before that. I'm not sure. But anyway, they were both interested, and so I ended up getting shows on both of those two networks right away. And then some people broke away from RBN, and all the truthers except me followed them. And then the new people at WTPRN, which was the spinoff, invited me. And so pretty suddenly I found myself with three radio shows on all three of the leading Patriot networks.
Wow.
And that kept me very busy, maybe a little too busy.
Well, I guess now those were weekly shows?
Yeah, one of them was 2 days a week and the other two were 1 day a week.
Okay.
And so that came to be a little bit too much. Mm-hmm. And so then one of the issues with GCN is that they don't have free archiving. So that was annoying.
Okay, yeah.
And for that reason, plus I actually was terminated from RBN for reasons I have no idea. John Stadtmiller is quite a character. I have no idea what was going through his mind. And then so I stepped down from GCN due to the archiving situation. And now I have a right-wing, let's just say a patriot movement show, sort of a post-patriot on this great new network, American Freedom Radio, which is the heir to We the People, and then also a show on this leftist Pacifica network, which is called NoLiesRadio.org.
Okay.
So, I think I'm the only person in the country with sort of a right-wing show and a left-wing show.
Yeah. Interesting. Nice. Yeah, there's a lot of work involved in putting on, a couple hours of radio a week. I don't know if you have any researchers and you're the producer and host solely yourself. It is a fair bit of work if you want to keep an interesting show going.
It certainly is. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
But the great thing about it is you get to talk to the most interesting people. You have an excuse for talking for a couple hours with interesting people every week.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite things is I can basically contact anyone on the planet and come up with a good reason to say I'm calling you. I've got a radio show, and that seems to open that unlocks absolutely everything. And I've really appreciated having that. I've got a radio show, and I'm wondering if I can talk to you. So there we are.
Indeed. Yeah. I've met people through asking them to go on the radio that I probably never would have met otherwise. Really, most interesting people out there.
Nice. So we are winding down again. Now, your website is truthjihad. Help me with the end.
.com.
.com. Okay. And jihad is J-I-H-A-D for you listeners out there. Any other websites? Any other future plans? Where is Kevin Barrett going from here?
Well, I want to keep writing books. This Questioning the War on Terror, where it's actually being looked at by a couple of publishers. I hope it gets picked up. If it doesn't, that's fine. Having the nonprofit just crank it out and for people to give away to their Obama voting friends is fine.
Okay.
And then I'm going to be turning my essay, Twilight of the Psychopaths, into a book. That essay got a lot of play on the Internet. It typically gets you somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 Google hits. So I think that's a really interesting book possibility, too.
Very nice. Well, I mean, we can certainly use, all the gifted writers that are out there willing. So, thank you for doing that.
Well, you're welcome, Raymond. If you have something to say, you have to say it, whether it's on the radio or in the form of a book.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for coming on today, and you've, as I promised our listeners, that you've been fairly busy the last 4 or 5 years in the truth movement, and I think we've just proven that.
Yeah, well, it's a long struggle. I kind of wish we'd won it a few years ago, so
yes,
we could all be basking on the beaches of Mexico celebrating.
Yeah. Okay, my friend, I'm going to say goodnight, and I want to thank you once again for staying up fairly late in your end of the woods.
Well, it's worth it, Raymond. I appreciate the work you're doing. Keep up the great work. Keep this show chugging along, and maybe I'll come back on it again someday.
That sounds fantastic, and I'm looking forward to the Jonathan Kay. I want to give a listen to yours before my interview with him. Okay, that'll do her. Thank you very much, Kevin Barrett.
Okay, take care, Raymond.
Good day.
Bye-bye.
Okay, very nice. So that was pretty good. And how am I feeling? Because I wasn't feeling too well today, and I pretty much spent the day in bed, and that's not a very good way to spend a day off, but that seems to be what happened. Now, what I'm going to do right now, I got a song, and then we're going to come back for the campus community update. Actually, it's going to be the events update. So as far as the song goes, this is from Bob Dylan's new CD. Came out maybe last month. It's called Beyond Here Lies Nothing. And I'll see you in a couple minutes after that. Be well. Very nice. Who is that events update brought to you by? Well, the fine people at Edmonton 9/11 Truth, Fraser Valley 9/11 Truth, and WarCriminalsOut.com. That's right. Three truth groups that obviously understand the importance of independent media like this one, like this CHLY. Thank goodness for CHLY. That's what I got to say. Okay, that's going to do it for that. Now, I was, hoping to get to this rough guide to conspiracy theories, in which they do, for the most part, a hack job on 9/11. It's, like I said, it's full of distortions and outright lies about the Truth Community's research on evidence. I don't know if I have the energy for that, to be quite honest. Not that it was a real long piece, but that's how it is, right? So while I'm debating whether or not we're going to get to that, I'm going to put on an audio piece or two or three or four. This first one here I promised last week, but it was meant for this week. This is an actor reading a lecture or a speech by Smedley Butler, the decorated Marine. It's entitled War is a Racket. You're going to enjoy this. This is a piece of history. If you don't know Smedley Butler, you're going to learn a lot right now, or Google him. And yeah, he's one of those names from history that, well, sadly is not well known. He's a hero, and, well, the corporate media is doing their best to not let that name be well known, I guess, eh? So let's get to that, Smedley Butler, and then, well, we'll just take it minute by minute, right? Okay, then. Here it comes.
War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. There are only two things we should fight for. One is the defense of our homes, and the other is the Bill of Rights. War for any other reason is simply a racket. It may seem odd for me, a military man, to adopt such a comparison. Truthfulness compels me to. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of this country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. I suspected I was just part of a racket at the time. Now I am sure of it. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1910. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I feel I could have given Al Capone a few tips. The best he could do was operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small, inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. In the World War, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them knew what it meant to go hungry in a rat-infested dugout? How many of them spent sleepless, frightened nights ducking shells and shrapnel and machine gun bullets? Out of war, nations acquire additional territory. If they are victorious, they just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few, the selfsame few who wrung dollars out of blood in the war. The general public shoulders the bill. It would have been far cheaper and safer for the average American who pays the bills to stay out of foreign entanglements. For a very few, this racket, like bootlegging and other underworld rackets, brings fancy profits. But the cost of operations is always transferred to the people who do not profit. Take the World War. It cost the United States taxpayer some $52 billion, and we haven't paid that debt yet. But ultimately, it's the soldier who pays the biggest part of the bill. If you don't believe this, visit the American cemeteries on the battlefields abroad, or visit any of the veterans' hospitals in the United States. Napoleon once said, "All men are enamored of decorations. They positively hunger for them." So, by developing the Napoleonic system, the medal business, the government learned it could get soldiers for less money, because the boys liked to be decorated. Until the Civil War, there were no medals.
Then the Congressional Medal of Honor was handed out. It made enlistments easier. In the World War, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription. They were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was this war propaganda that even God was brought into it. With few exceptions, our clergymen joined in the clamor to kill, kill, kill. To kill the Germans, God is on our side. It is His will that the Germans be killed. And in Germany, the good pastors called upon the Germans to kill the Allies, to please the same God. Beautiful ideals were painted for our boys who were sent out to die. This was the war to end all wars. This was the war to make the world safe for democracy. No one mentioned to them as they marched away that their going and their dying would mean huge war profits. Thus, having stuffed patriotism down their throats, it was decided to help make them pay for the war, too. So we gave them the large salary of $30 a month. All they had to do for this munificent sum was to leave their dear ones behind, give up their jobs, lie in swampy trenches, and kill, and kill, and kill. And be killed. Well, war is a racket, all right. And the only way to smash this racket is to conscript capital, industry, and labor before the nation's manhood can be conscripted. Let all the officers, directors, high-powered executives, all the workers, managers, bankers, and yes, all the generals, admirals, officers, and all politicians, all government office holders, everyone in the nation, be restricted to a total monthly income not to exceed that paid to the soldier. Why shouldn't they? They aren't running any risk of being killed or having their bodies mangled or their minds shattered. The soldiers are! Give capital, industry, and labor 30 days to think it over, and I think you will find by that time there will be no war. Another step necessary in the fight to smash the war racket is the limited plebiscite to determine whether a war should be declared. A plebiscite not of all the voters, but merely of those who would be called upon to do the fighting and dying. There wouldn't be very much sense in having the president of a munitions factory or the head of an international banking firm or the manager of a uniform manufacturing plant, all of whom see visions of tremendous profits in the event of war, voting on whether the nation should go to war or not. They never would be called upon to shoulder arms. Only those who would be called upon to risk their lives for their country should have the privilege of voting to determine whether the nation should go to war. That would smash the war racket. That and nothing else. The next war, according to experts, will be fought not with battleships, not by artillery, not with rifles, and not with machine guns. It will be fought with deadly chemicals and gases. But victory or defeat will be determined by the skill and ingenuity of our scientists. If we put them to work making poison gas and more fiendish mechanical and explosive instruments of destruction, they will have no time for the constructive job of building a greater prosperity for all peoples. By putting them to this useful job, we can all make more money out of peace than we can out of war. So, I say, to hell with war!
There we go, to hell with war, eh? Smedley Butler. Well done. I don't know the name of the actor reading that. So there you are, Smedley Butler, true hero. And I have decided I'm going to skip reading that piece on the Rough Guide to Conspiracy Theories. And it's interesting because I just got it a couple days ago and certainly haven't finished it, but there was one fascinating piece on the military-industrial complex. And, you know, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's a conspiracy fact. And they were real accurate with that, and they didn't toy around. They just took out real juicy pieces of history and laid out the facts, and they did a fantastic job. And they didn't do so with 9/11, and I'm going to give them what they got coming probably next week. So let's move on to another audio piece. Chris sent me this one a little while back. This comes from a Denver public broadcast station, KBDI, and this is during a fun drive, and they were playing the 9/11 Truth movie, Press for Truth, during their fun drive, and well done for them, and apparently it was a huge success, and that's what I'm going to play for you now. It's a 10-minute segment. It has one or two small clips from the movie Press for Truth, but it's primarily the hosts of the fund drive, as well as the producer of Press for Truth, and one of the gentlemen who appeared in the film whose son died on 9/11. So that's what you're going to hear right now, a Denver Public Broadcasting Station, their fund drive. Here we go.
Thank you for joining us for this very powerful documentary, 9/11 Press for Truth. You're watching KBDI Channel 12. My name is Sherry Bernson, and I'm joined by one of the producers from the film, Kyle Hentz. Welcome, Kyle.
Good to be here.
We've got the Colorado 9/11 visibility people in the phones, and the reason this station is taking the risk of airing this documentary, we're the first broadcaster in the country to air this, is because of you. You know, we aired a documentary called Freedom to Fascism. We offered 9/11 Press for Truth. The DVD is one of the thank yous, and we got so much response from the community telling us that they wanted to see content of this nature. So right now, it's your chance to call in with your comments. It's your chance to call in with your pledges of support. Some great guests here, and we're going to be giving you a lot of information during these breaks. So, Kyle, tell us about this amazing film.
Well, this is a film that just had to be made. This is a story that had to be told because the American people deserve to know the truth about that fateful day. And to this day, we do not. The 9/11 Commission failed the families, and they failed this nation. And we felt that this was a compelling story. It brought together pieces of their story that had never been told before, and showed the Commission to be deficient, to be set up to fail. In the words of the chairman of the commission himself said that the commission was set up to fail, and it did, and we deserve to get to the bottom of what happened of that fateful day, because the world has been turned upside down in the wake of those events.
My name is Laura Van Auken. My husband, Kenneth Van Auken, was killed on September 11th at the World Trade Center. He was on the 105th floor of the North Tower, which was the first building that was hit and the second building to collapse.
My name is Patricia Casaza. I lost my husband, John Casaza. He worked for Cantor Fitzgerald on the 104th floor of the first tower.
My name is Mindy Kleinberg, and I lost my husband, Alan. He worked for Cantor Fitzgerald on the 104th floor.
These women banded together after their husbands were killed, and now they're leading a campaign to find out exactly how did 9/11 happen.
And finally, the media began to report on our activities. Not just the activities of the administration.
Yes, I'm joined by Bob McElvain, our very special guest. Bob's featured in the film, and Bob, unfortunately, I'm so sorry, Bobby, lost his son, Bobby, 9/11, and we're so happy to have you here. And Bob's going to really share with us his story, and he's been doing so much work and was really involved with this project, but just not from the get-go. You kind of became involved with the project.
Yeah, well, I just want to briefly mention Bobby. He's a Princeton graduate and had just started working up at Merrill Lynch, which was right across the street from the North Tower. And that day he was murdered. And it took me, you know, you spend at least 6 months grieving. So I really didn't think about 9/11. But then I started having questions, and I made every 9/11 commission hearing. And after those hearings, especially when Condoleezza Rice testified, that's when my real anger comes out. And I feel it's very important because I have so much anger. I have an obligation. My son was murdered. And the information that we got from the commission was just bogus. It was a fraud. And so with that anger, I've made it a mission that this is my job as a parent. My son was murdered. We've never, and I'd like everyone to put themselves in my position, that you have or I have an obligation to investigate my son's murder. And it's been a long, hard journey. A day like today is so emotional. I've been standing here crying because you're watching your son get murdered. That's the bottom line. And that's brutal. And that's why so many people don't want to deal with it, because it is such a brutal, brutal day.
To be in the way of some of these families. I mean, they're...
Kissinger was soon replaced by Tom Keene, a former New Jersey governor, and former Congressman Lee Hamilton, who had chaired the House Intelligence Committee. The remaining eight commissioners were all former D.C. insiders and lawyers, evenly split between Republicans and Democrats.
Remember in the 90s, they spent $100 million investigating Clinton's sexual exploits. $100 million. And they first allocated only $3 million to investigate the murder of 3,000 people.
At 1-800-690-5234 or log on to kbdi.org. We've got some great thank you gifts for you if you'd like to increase your pledge of support. At the $100 level for the year, you're going to receive both the director's cut with unseen footage in this broadcast, as well as what ended up on the cutting room floor and is it a longer DVD in their own words at the $100 level. At $150 for the year, you'll receive both of the DVDs plus the new Pearl Harbor Revisited. It's a softcover book. We'll be telling you a little bit more about that. And at $200 for the year, it's the two DVDs and a DVD that really looks at the physical evidence of 9/11, Blueprint 9/11, and a Fabled Enemies DVD from the director of Loose Change. These are thank you gifts for you that were actually suggested to us by our members and our viewers. So get on the phone right now. So much great information, and in fact, right now we're offering you these great thank you gifts so you can do your own investigation. You know, do your own study. Take responsibility for getting out and finding out about the information that really matters to you. So we've got Ray. He's here. The director is here with us, and he's over with the Rebecca Stevens. Let's go there.
Thanks so much, Shailene. Kyle and Sherry, this is Ray Novoselsky, who is the director of 9/11 Press for Truth. Ray, how has this project affected you? Ray is only 28 years old, but this has to have changed your life.
Yeah, well, it's played to over 10 million viewers overseas on foreign TV, so we've gotten sort of recognition all around the world. Strangely enough, here in the U.S., you guys are the first broadcast outlet to touch it, so we do want to thank you for
doing
that.
And we're honored to have you show up here and be able to be with us tonight. Now, you flew in from Los Angeles, if I can say that. Tell me a little bit. You're also working on a new project. Tell me about your new project as well.
Well, we're trying to find the funding. We've been developing this for over a year, and we've been pitching various outlets. It's called Footnote 44, and it kind of picks up where this one left off in a way. On the morning that the 9/11 Commission report was released, the 9/11 family members that you see in the movie were brought in for a special sort of sneak preview of the book before public consumption. And on that day, they knew that after they left that, they were going to be asked by reporters immediately, what do you think of the book? What do you think? So they were feverishly flipping through it. And Kristen Breitweiser, one of the Jersey girls, tells a story where she just happened to have flipped open the first page she found. She looks, 44th footnote to chapter 6, and what they find is something they'd never seen before, which is that the CIA deliberately, in January of 2000, was aware that two 9/11 hijackers, two Al-Qaeda terrorists were coming to the country, and they hid that from the FBI.
Amazing.
So it's a search for that.
Amazing. Bob?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention or talk about Press for Truth. I just can't believe how many people, and I'm talking worldwide. I remember when we first made it, I forget when, it was a few years back. But my relatives, when I first mentioned something about 9/11, they all looked like at me, I was nuts. And there's a lot of information that we've given you. And it's really too much to take in. Well, Press for Truth sort of does that for you. And again, I've given it to my relatives. And they've looked at it, and the only thing that it did in the beginning is that they began to question. And that's all I would want out of this, is the fact that you just don't believe me. I mean, I do my own thing. You know, this is for me. This is my transformation. But Press for Truth will just give you, hopefully, those little things that you will say, geez, there is doubt about 9/11. And then maybe you will look into it. And the more people look into it, the better this country will be, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, thank you, and thanks to all of the great folks who have called in with their comments. If you have other comments, you can log on to kbdi.org, click on Community, click on Viewer Buzz. Everybody who works here at the station reads those comments that come in via the email. And, you know, we're here for you. Thanks for acknowledging and noticing that we're really trying to do something different here at the KBDI studios.
And what about the local groups?
Yes, we've got to thank the Colorado 9/11 Visibility Group. Thank you so much, Kyle. Let's give them a hand. Fran Scher, Earl Stalen have been on with us during these breaks right now. This group has helped us bring these distinguished guests into the Colorado community. They're putting them up. They're shuffling them to the airport. It's really because of them that we've been able to bring this to you. So it looks like they're counting us out right now. Thank you so much, gentlemen. We couldn't have done it without you. We appreciate you so much. Thanks for your great work.
There it is. There it is. Pretty impressive, eh? Wow. Let that be an example, that's for sure. So, well done to the Denver Truthers. We're going to move on now to a New York Truther. This is Luke Radowski. He's being interviewed by a Russian television network, RT. And Luke is the founder and member of We Are Change. And there are numerous, there's maybe, I'm going to guess, 75 chapters around the world and a handful in Canada as well of We Are Change. So let's move on to this audio clip, this interview of Luke Radowski, founder and member of We Are Change. Okay, I'll see you in a little while.
RT is sitting down with Luke Radowski, American activist, journalist, and the founder of the organization We Are Change. Luke, thanks for sitting down with us today. Now, can you tell us more about your organization? What kind of change are you exactly?
We Are Change is a grassroots, bottom-up organization that talks about real issues that the mainstream media never even wants to touch or deal with. We are activist journalists going out there asking the hard questions to journalists, corporations, big banks that the mainstream media never even dares to ask, and we get amazing reactions. We put those videos out on the internet, and people get to see true, unedited, real journalism without no corporate sponsors.
What are the hard questions?
Well, we go up to members of the secretive elite Bilderberg group, and we ask them, you know, we shake their hands and we ask, can you please tell us what happens when you meet with the world's elites in banking, media, corporations, and governments all around the world in secret? And whenever we ask them this question, we get amazing responses. I mean, I literally had people shaking my hand, and as soon as I stopped asking the question, this person just literally walks away from me in silence. You see just a shock on his face, and he walks away without even talking to me after I was just shaking his hand. I actually had Vernon Jordan tell me, we want it secret. We want it private. There's no need for the media to be there. And that's where they set the real policy. I mean, even the chairman of the Bilderberg Group came out recently and said that he helped, the Bilderberg Group helped establish the European Union. And then these people are going to tell me that they don't establish policy. We keep putting them on record. And we get many important things on the record. We confront politicians about the truth behind 9/11. Our confrontation with Senator Joe Biden went viral all over the internet because we asked him what he was doing with the financing of Muhammad Atta before 9/11, after 9/11, and even on the day of 9/11 when he met with the Pakistani chief of the ISI, Mohammed Ahmed, who financed Muhammad Atta and wired $100,000 to him. We asked him, why were you meeting with the financer of Muhammad Atta, you know, days within 9/11? And he told me, you know, there's diplomatic immunity. We didn't arrest Khrushchev when he came here. But I'm like, this is the hijacker. Osama bin Laden is still free. You know what he told me? He said, get a life, kid. Get out of here. I mean, our work is amazing because we put people on record and they knowingly lie to us. And we have the documents. We have the sources. We have the video that prove that these people are lying to us. Lying to us. These politicians are lying to us. We confronted hundreds of politicians, even celebrities, and who, you know, give us endorsements and support us in what we're doing. But it's key to go out there as a real journalist and ask the questions that the mainstream media is not asking. And they're not asking real questions. And for doing that, we get persecution, we get death threats, harassment, and even, you know, I even got arrested, falsely arrested a couple days ago because of it.
What do you think America needs, and why would it want the kind of change that you are offering?
Look what kind of world we're living in right now. The wars are continuing. Taxes are getting bigger. The elite are getting stronger. 1% of the population owns pretty much 80% of the world's wealth, and the people right now more than ever are getting screwed over by these elitists, and we have to expose that and tell everybody we are the people. We are the majority of the people. We have the power and authority to do what we want, and we have to start rising up and believing in ourselves and empowering ourselves as human beings.
What about the change that the American government is offering? Why is that not enough for you?
Because it's not really changed. It's the same policies. People have to understand, even though there's a Democrat now in office, then before there was a Republican, the elite institutions like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, they hold power, whether it's Democratic or a Republican president, because they are the institutions of the elite globalists who are running things behind the scenes. It is these people that institute these policies, and these policies are the same. I mean, the wars are continuing. Barack Obama sends 17,000 troops to Afghanistan. He's leaving troops in Iraq. He's bombing Pakistan. That's pretty much the same policies as the Bush administration. He's also keeping Bush documents secret. His Justice Department is not going after the Bush administration, actually protecting them. They're also keeping policies of rendition. And, you know, everybody thinks, you know, Barack Obama closed down Guantanamo Bay, but there's still Bagram Airport open in Iraq that Obama wants to leave open, twice as big as Guantanamo Bay, that tortures people. And, of course, the policy of rendition is still one of his favorites that he is keeping from the Bush administration. So we see more of the same policies being kept the same.
Why do the people who oppose you call you guys conspiracy theorists and basically say that what you claim is not true?
There's nothing theoretical about what we talk about. We have sources, we have documents, we have evidence, and we go out there as real journalists and we talk to people. We show people documents. We show people, you know, even mainstream news articles that admit to everything that's happening right now. People call us conspiracy theorists because it's a bad name. It's a dirty word. I don't theorize on anything. I'm not a theorist, but they say I do because they want to make believe what I'm doing is fake, and all the real issues that I'm covering are just theories and they're not truth. But they are truth, and we find out that they really are extremely important to us when we go out there into the field and talk to the people that we need to talk to.
You're one of the organizers of many protests, both in New York and all over the United States. What are you trying to achieve by these protests, and is it really a way to get your point across to the people?
I really don't like to say protest. What we really do out there is we go out there every Saturday, and some people call it a protest. I call it a vigil when we go out there, and we have 5,000 flyers, and we have hundreds of DVDs, and we give those out for free to the people, and we talk to people. That is way more important than holding a protest and screaming to each other, holding signs to each other, and we talk to people. We ask them, what do they think, and do they know about this, and we show them the documents. We show them the, you know, we give them pamphlets and DVDs so they can watch home and make up their own mind.
You were recently arrested for allegedly trying to question the mayor of New York. What happened there exactly? Why were you arrested?
Well, I actually went out to an event that Mayor Bloomberg was doing. Mayor Bloomberg knows me well, very well, because within the last couple of months, he actually said if I left him alone, he would help support the 9/11 first responders, all those heroes who are sick and dying. I laid off of him. I stopped, you know, trying to interview him. I stopped asking the hard questions to him. And just recently, I had first responders contact me and tell me, Luke, he lied. He just cut 5,000 workplace benefits for first responders. He's not supporting the James Shedroga bill. He's not helping us out. He lied. Luke, please go get him. Please go ask him the real questions about why he's not helping the sick and dying 9/11 first responders, and why is he denying even more help than ever before today, when we need it most. So I went out there to an event at Mayor Bloomberg. As soon as I went out there, I had police intelligence identify me, take me away, bring me downstairs, and they said, you're detained. I was asking, can I please leave? Can I please get out of here? They were like, no, you're detained. You stay here. You can't go anywhere. They had guards around me at all times. They came back within a couple minutes saying, we told him to leave. He wouldn't leave. And then they arrested me. And then I spent Saturday and Sunday in the bookings. They kept all the video cameras that I had. Everything that happened, they are keeping the video cameras. They're keeping the evidence of what happened that day as criminal evidence. So I don't even have my cameras with me today. My friends who came and were filming me getting arrested, just filming me getting arrested, they were also arrested for criminal trespassing. So it was me and three of my friends who are now facing criminal trespassing charges for trying to go out there and ask Mayor Bloomberg a serious question about why is he not supporting real 9/11 heroes who are sick and dying from the government's lie on 9/11.
You do a lot of work trying to bring the attention of the American public back to the events of 9/11. And I've personally witnessed a couple of your protests and a couple of your events, and I've seen people often get pretty aggressive about what you were saying and claiming. Why do you think that is?
9/11 is very emotional to many people. Many people were very affected by it. I was, but people don't understand. I mean, the mainstream media targets us as terrorists, as these crazy conspiracy theorists. These guys are crazy and loony. They don't know what they're talking about. But that's not what we're about, and people don't understand us. So I always try to calm people down and make them understand that it was the victim family members who started this movement. We have sources and documents and real evidence that people really need to look at to understand 9/11. We do know what we're talking about. We know what we want. And the family members are not getting the justice. First responders are still sick and dying from 9/11 because they were were lied to about the air quality.
Would you consider yourself a revolutionary?
I don't know what you would consider me. I'm just trying to do as much as I can in my young life to affect the positive changes I can. We raise money to help first responders. We're more of a community grassroots organization trying to help people with education, information, and proper health care for the first responders.
The reason I'm asking that is because the number of people, namely freedom activists, tends to be growing. People who say that possibly in the next couple of years there's going to be a sort of a revolution in the United States. What is your opinion on this?
People are slowly waking up because they're being more affected now than ever. I mean, and people are seeing that we were right. We were right about the economy. We were right about Barack Obama. When everybody was saying the economy is going to be fine, when everybody's saying, oh, Obama's going to be the biggest change, the greatest guy, the Messiah, we were telling people, no, we have to understand things. And we only know things because we look at their documents. We see what the globalists and elites say. We understand that because we study and research the subject at length. And people see that we have a greater understanding and grasp than the mainstream media. The mainstream media is failing right now. Nobody's buying their newspapers. People aren't watching TV as much as they can. They're going on the internet. And when they go on the internet, they can look at things whatever they want. And they have that freedom. Within a couple strokes of that keyboard, they can look up and know anything they want. And they get a funny feeling. There's something inside. You know, people right now that are slowly waking them up saying there's something wrong right now. There's something that the government and media are not telling us. There's something that these corporations are doing wrong, and they're going on our website and saying we were right all this time. And now they're joining us, and they're joining, you know, our organization has grown to 90 chapters within 2 years.
My last question, what kind of future do you want to see for the United States?
Right now we're in economic turmoil, and throughout history, you look at governments like China, Russia, and Germany, whenever there's economic turmoil, you have people like, you know, Mao Zedong, Stalin, and Hitler rise up with the cult of personality, very similar to what Barack Obama, with his cult of personality. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I see a huge uprising right now of people waking up every single day.
Luke Rudowski, thank you for your time with us.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Okay, there it is, Luke Wadowski. We are changed, and it's 90 chapters, not 75. So, hey, just a reminder, you're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM from downtown Nanaimo, Vancouver Island. If you ever want to contact me, maybe you got a guest or a topic for a discussion, you can do that. This is my email. I'm at RaymondTruthRadio@hotmail.com. That's RaymondTruthRadio@hotmail.com. I've got a simple website where I explained what was on each show. So if you also have lots of links as well, you like these audio pieces, you know, most of them are taken from YouTube. So if you want to watch them yourself, you know, there'll be links. So my website is, what is it? Unbossed.livejournal.com. That's Unbossed, UnbossedLivejournal.com. And these shows are archived. If you missed one, just go to that website and you can listen to past shows. Okay, what else? It's 9:50 here. Let's carry on. I'll keep us going till 10 for sure. And I've got a fun piece. Well, it's not really that fun. It's an audio piece. It's from a short film called The Astounding World of the Future. And it's an attempt to be a funny mid-century newsreel. You know, it's like a faux newsreel featuring, well, amazingly accurate predictions for the year 2000. This short film won Best Film at the Comedy Film Festival of New York. The writer and director is Scott Dickers, and Peter from Victoria forwarded me this one. So here we are, The Astounding World of the Future.
What will life be like in the future? Will we see gleaming cities and unimagined scientific marvels in the years to come? In this moving picture, we'll peer across time into the year 2000, into the astounding world of the future. Gaze upon the city of tomorrow, magnificent architecture of an age not yet known. A sparkling city that stretches for miles and miles like the palace of the gods. And look, personal transport pods hurtling down super boulevards at lightning speed. But what of the citizens of this gleaming metropolis? Behold, the man of 2000. His speeding jet pod is a home away from home with temperature control and an onboard amusement center that plays his favorite radio drama programs. Now this real-life Buck Rogers is visiting his local bank. But where's the bank teller? Why, at this bank of the future, customers needn't worry about waiting in line to speak with an error-prone human teller. No, this push-button robot banker can handle any transaction instantly and with courtesy. You're welcome, Mr. Robot Banker. Have a nice day. Future man can even check in with the home port on his space beam communicator. Honey, I'm calling from my transport pod. Well, sure, dear. I'll be glad to pick up some energy pills and rocket fuel on the way home. Life in the future is a dream world where every desire is met with a dazzling electronic device. But like everyone else, the man of the future has to obey the robot traffic cop. In the next century, everyone will live in magnificent city-state towers which stretch as far as the eye can see. They'll house hundreds in tightly knit communities, complete with local governing authority, a food and beverage market offering delicacies prepared entirely by robots, never touched by human hands, and every citizen will have his own robot butler. Thanks for the messages, Jeeves. The little lady of the future will no longer slave over the hot stove to prepare her husband's meals. No, she'll use an automatic heat ray oven. Just press the button and, a hearty space-age meal. Clothing for the fairer sex will be form-fitting bodysuits made of as-yet-unimagined fibers that accentuate every curve. And now the lord of the manor sits back, relaxes, and enjoys this bedazzling, far-flung future. But if you think he had a hard day at work, think again. In this glorious age, mechanical robots and super-brain calculating machines do all the work. With their newfound leisure time, the super-intelligent citizens of tomorrow will congregate in their sleek city-state dwellings. They will educate themselves with photoplays flashed directly into the home, featuring fine arts, culture, and the latest scientific teachings. There's no reason why everyone shouldn't be happy in this future wonderland, but in the off chance you've got the blues, don't despair. A peppy smile and a spring in your step all come in an amazing happy pill. Now, future man is using the amazing picture phone for communication across the globe. No one need ever be lonely again. Hi, Mom. Or is that Sis? The picture phone will be connected to a super calculating brain, able to search the answer to any question, no matter how profound, no matter how perplexing. Say, how about we pay a visit to Grandma? But it's not just over the river and through the woods anymore. Grandma lives over 1,000 miles away. That's no problem in the future. Jet rocket cars will shuttle people across the globe at the slightest whim. First, a pleasurable ride on a series of conveyor belt walkways, then onto the launch pad. 3, 2, 1, blast off! Soaring above the clouds sure brings new meaning to the idea of traveling in high style. Grandma sure has it good. Super vitamin energy pills will add decades to her life. As if sipping from the fabled fountain of youth, she'll live on and on and on. And she'll live in a special community set aside for the cherishment of our elders. Every need fulfilled with adoring respect as our grandparents entertain world leaders and great thinkers who journey from afar to partake of their aged wisdom. Why, what's this? You guessed it, a robot bed that changes its shape to suit the slightest whim of human comfort. Why, who wouldn't want to live forever in this dazzling utopia? Truly the astounding world of the future.
Hey, there we go, the astounding world of the future. Now, who was that by again? Scott Dickers. Well done. Some of those are sight gags. You know, especially with Grandma, you know, in a comatose state. Yeah, well, like I said, go to my website. You can watch it yourself. That's going to do it for tonight's show, the Unbought and Unbossed show. What are we at, number 126? I can't remember. I don't think I've got an interview lined up for next week yet. We'll find out what happens, right? So I'd like to thank you for tuning in and turning on and getting down to the truth. The Unbought and Unbossed show. What did we do? Kevin Barrett interview in the first hour. That was Boy, we covered a lot of topics. That guy's been awfully busy. And so that's pretty neat. Thanks to Kevin. I'm going to play another song to take us out. This is another Bob Dylan song. The first one I played is from his latest album. And this one here, Masters of War, is from his second album. And, man, this guy was a kid when he wrote this. He was like 21, 22 years old. And I don't know, man. I didn't know. I wish I knew what I know now at 22, that's for sure, because I didn't then. And anyways, this is Masters of War. And we'll see you next week. Another reminder, there's no show after this one. We got an empty hour. So if you got something you need to say or some music that's you're not hearing elsewhere, this is a good place for it. Okay, friends. So who do we got coming in? We got Sandeep at 11 with the late shift. So there we go. So stick around, and we'll take it out with Bob Dylan's Master of War.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing. Built to destroy. You play with my world. Like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. He's thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. A voice threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? But to talk out of turn, you must say that I'm young. You must say I'm unlearned. But there's the one thing I know. I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Or will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon. I watch while you lord down to your deathbed, and I stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.